It was 1978, and I was in sixth grade. And my hippie social studies teacher, whose name was Miss Gale, decided to offer yoga club after our last period on a Wednesdays. And so I signed up for yoga club. I had no idea what it was. I was 12 years old. And I thought, okay, this sounds interesting. She was like the real deal. You know, she wore like proto Birkenstocks. That was before Birkenstocks. And she wore like printed long flower skirts. And she had these big, big kind of tinted glasses. And I remember like, Miss Gale is really cool. And I didn't know, like I went to the class and I didn't really know much about what we were doing. I remember sort of like putting my body in these weird shapes. And then at the end, we would lie on our backs and she would guide us through this relaxation through all the parts of our body. And I remember having this experience as a young girl of almost feeling like I was floating out of my body and having a feeling like it's something I had never felt before. And that was my first, those 6 weeks when I had yoga club was like my first introduction to this stuff. So fast forward, it's 1988 and I'm in grad school and I'm very stressed out because I'm reading, I was getting a master's degree in literature and I'm reading one book and I'm writing one paper like every day, it felt like, you know. And my friend who was also in school with me at the time was like, come with me to yoga. You know, it's 1988 and like yoga is really weird. Everybody does aerobics or jogs, you know, or there was a little tennis too, but that was about it, you know. So I'm like, okay, I'll go to the gym with her. And she's like, we have a real Indian Swami as our teacher. And there was a guy with like a long black beard and wearing a turban and saying things like, and now I'd like you to contract your anus. Stuff like that. And I'd be like, okay, really weird. This yoga stuff is really weird. And he had a woman who wore a unitard and she was always standing. She was like on her head for the whole class. She was like his assistant, you know. So it's 1988 and I'm doing yoga and I'm like, yoga's really weird. I hope nobody sees me coming and going from this class because it's a really strange thing. And then at the end of that year, it was 1989, I moved to San Francisco. And then at that time, there were two yoga studios in the Bay Area. One was the Iyengar Institute. The other one was a place that I would drive by and think, like, I don't know what goes on in there. But I wasn't that interested in going into either of them. And one of the things that I did that I noticed, you know, from Miss Gale and then from our real Swami, and then when I got to San Francisco, I was studying Chinese medicine and acupuncture, and one of my teachers taught us what they called acu-yoga, which is when you did different yoga postures and you pushed on different acupressure points while you're doing the yoga postures, you know. So, and it was really cool. And from all those experiences I had, I was so interested in Asian healing arts that I left San Francisco, I left this country, and I moved to Asia. I lived in Asia for 4 years. And first I started in Japan because I needed to make some money so that I could, you know, fund my travels around Asia. And then eventually I got to India and I spent a lot of time at ashrams. And the stuff that I learned was the stuff that Miss Gale had taught me and the stuff I learned from the weird Swami and the stuff that I had started to learn a little bit in San Francisco. It was this slow, mindful, very intentional, very internal kind of practices. When I returned to the United States, it was 1995, and I was living in a suburb in New Jersey, and I thought, I don't really want to do anything except teach yoga and do some body work. You know, I studied Asian body work, so I started doing body work and to make some money, and I started teaching yoga, and I was doing okay. You know, it was a suburb of New Jersey, people were coming. And then one day somebody turned up and they're like, why don't you teach the vinyasa stuff? And I was like, what's that? Like, I had no idea what it was. And they're like, well, come to a class with me. So I went to this class, it was at a gym. It might have been like 1997 at that point, I went to this class. And I get in and I hear the boom, boom, boom of the bass because there's like this thumping music going on in this room. And I get in and the people are wearing like outfits like hardly anything, you know? And the room is really warm and the music's really pumping. And we start this like fast, almost dance practice of sun salutations to music. And I was like, what is this? Like, I just had no idea what I was doing. It was kind of fun. It was kind of like dancing. It was kind of interesting. But I was not nearly as flexible as anybody else in that room. And I also was like, this isn't what I learned in Asia. And so what's going on with this stuff? And I wanted to know more. So I started to like go to New York City, because I was living close by, and Philadelphia, and studying different kinds of yoga. And then the yoga world just was going, you know, it was just exploding in the late 90s. We got to Asheville in 2001. And, you know, I had done some of these other, I had taken some of these other stuff, but I was still teaching, you know, I was still teaching the core of what I learned in India, the core of the stuff I learned even from Miss Gale back in middle school. And so when I got to Asheville in 2001, everybody was doing flow yoga, you know, everybody was doing vinyasa flow yoga. And nobody took me seriously. Like, I couldn't get a job, you know, I couldn't, like, and the yoga studios were like, eh. And, you know, I just didn't fit the look or the times, you know, which was this very, at that time, yoga was very hot, very strenuous, very, it was all about maximizing this physical capacity, you know. And I thought, you know, gosh, what I do, this like slow, mindful, internal stuff is actually really good, but I had no way of explaining it to anybody. I would just be like, well, it's relaxing, you know, but people didn't really necessarily want to relax, and my classes were not really doing very well, and I didn't, like, my career wasn't going anywhere, essentially. So I made a decision in 2003, because some of my students were like, because I was trying to teach the vinyasa stuff, you know, I was like, maybe I need to teach that, because that's what everybody else is doing. So I was trying to do it, and in 2003, I made a decision. I was like, you know, I'm just going to, like, teach the stuff that I know. And so I decided to call it subtle yoga, because I wanted to differentiate from the other stuff that was out there, you know. And at that time, I realized if I don't, I was just like putting it together. I was like, first of all, I need to have like kind of a good marketing message behind it. And second, the second thing is that I need to understand what are the mechanisms behind this that differentiate it from the fast fitness stuff that's so popular, you know, and so out there. And I remember thinking, like, I remember feeling like, gosh, nobody's at my class one day. And I was like, they're all probably at that fast fitness class. And then it dawned on me, I was like, of course they're at the fast fitness class, because everybody knows that you have to exercise two or three times or four times a week. Everybody knows that. That is so deep in our consciousness, right? And so they're like, I like yoga, so I'll go to yoga and that'll be my exercise, right? But what we don't know, what's not really strong in our culture yet, is the fact that we need to move slow, is the fact that we need to slow down. And there are specific neurobiologic benefits of doing that that you don't get from fast fitness yoga. So I'm going to start the presentation tonight with a quote from Pico Iyer. He is actually an Indian writer who was born in his of Indian descent, who was born in England, then moved to the United States. And one of the things he specializes in writing are stories about this kind of global citizen that we've become. You know, that people live in different places and we're from different cultures, and what, you know, how that affects us as culturally, how it affects us individually. And I thought this was such a perfect quote. In an age of speed, I began to think nothing could be more invigorating than going slow. In an age of distraction, nothing could feel more luxurious than paying attention. In an age of constant movement, nothing is more urgent than sitting still. And this, I believe this, but I still needed to find a way to explain it, you know? So that's what this presentation is going to be about today, is some of the way to explain why this stuff is useful. And then at the end of the presentation, we'll have some time to do some movement. I've got a little handout. And then after that, we will, I'll have time for Q&A, okay? So, physical exercise. Let's start with physical exercise. And here's what I want to say about physical exercise. Physical exercise is good, right? And everybody knows that. right? In there was a physical culture movement. I'll tell you a little bit about the history. A physical culture movement started to emerge, particularly in Europe, in the middle part of the 19th century. And one of the reasons it began to emerge is because of changes in industry that made people a little bit more sedentary than they had been, and governments wanting to prepare their citizens for the inevitability of war. And so it caught on a little bit later in the United States because we were not having as much of, you know, after the Civil War, we weren't having as much of that threat of war. But this it was called physical culture. So this idea of physical culture started to become sort of important in the 19th century. In the 20th century, particularly in the early part of the 20th century, we see the emergence of even more of this physical or movement cultures. And yoga becomes part of that, actually. Even for Westerners, even way back then in the early part of the 20th century. But it's really after World War II, and really even after the 60s, it's the middle of the 60s, that we really start to see an emergence of research around why physical exercise is so good for you. So Don and Betty Draper were probably not exercising that much, you know. It's right at that moment of time when things started to shift with the Beatles that the information starts to come in about the importance of physical exercise. And one key player in that conversation is a guy named Dr. Kenneth Cooper. And Dr. Can you remember him? Dr. Kenneth Cooper wrote a book called Aerobics, and it came out in 1969, and that kind of like started to the whole movement, this whole exercise movement. So you get people wanting to jog, you get people wanting to go to the gym. Gyms actually had started to emerge in a few decades earlier. You have like the muscle men stuff, you know. But now you're getting like regular people and women involved in wanting to do this cardiovascular exercise. So we know, and the research for 50 years has been, I mean, most of us don't even think about it because we know how important this physical exercise is. That being said, only 20% of the U.S. population actually does any physical exercise, which is, that's a little shocking, isn't it? So, you know, so 4 out of 5 people are not getting the physical exercise that they need. That's another little in for some slow, mindful movement, which may be more, you know, people are in pain. We have a pain epidemic. There's lots of reasons why people don't. We have obesity epidemic. There's lots of reasons why people don't move, you know. So, you know, this is another way in for the slow stuff. But let me just kind of wrap up with, well, it's going to take me a little longer to get back to exercise. We have evidence base of exercise, a strong evidence base, many, many articles, many research studies that show that exercise is good for depression, for example. There are some studies that show that exercise is better for depression, for mid-grade depression, not major depressive disorders, than antidepressants even. You know, that's how beneficial exercise is for depression. We know that it's good for cardiovascular disease. Dean Ornish's work on cardiovascular disease, it took him 18 years, but he took a lifestyle program that includes yoga and meditation and diet, and he kind of based it on the traditional program that he learned from his guru, Swami Satchidananda, at the ashram, you know, the guy who owned at Woodstock. He learned it from him, and he created the Ornish Spectrum Program, which is being implemented in hospitals all over the country and is covered by Medicare. So, yeah, so, I mean, like, this, everybody knows exercise is good. Everybody knows it works for, it can actually reverse heart disease. It's good for hypertension or high blood pressure, good for diabetes, cancer, osteoporosis, and even, in some cases, can help delay the inevitable for some people. So I'm thinking about this exercise, and what do we know about the mechanisms? Like, why does it work, right? Why does exercise work? One of the major reasons that it works is because it reduces inflammation. So they used to say, like, fat and clogging your arteries was what created heart disease. But now they're saying, no, it's about inflammation. Inflammation in the system causes many different kinds of problems. So we know that exercise helps to reduce inflammation. They even show higher levels, that you have higher levels of stress of certain inflammatory markers like C-reactive protein and interleukin-6, and they know that with exercise that stuff goes down in tests. So lots of reasons to, you know, lots of good reasons behind these mechanisms. The other mechanism is that it optimizes the stress response, what's called the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. We know that exercise also promotes neuroplasticity. That means being able to change some of the circuitry in the brain. There's lots of research that shows, for example, that people who are prone to depression have more asymmetries in the hemispheres of the brain, and they often are more biased towards the left hemisphere, which means that that bias towards the left hemisphere, it also it sort of translates or correlates with a depressed affect or less positive outlook on life. So we know that we can change that through exercise. We also know this important neurotransmitter called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which kind of keeps your neurons alive. We know that that increases with exercise. So basically, the mechanism of exercise is helping you to deal with stress. We know there's so much good evidence out there for exercise. Like, there's, you know, if you could put it in a bottle, the pharmaceutical companies would make a fortune because it's so much better than many of the things that are in bottles, you know. I remember when I was studying Chinese medicine, my teacher said, the first thing that you do when someone comes in and tells you they have these different aches and pains and problems and digestive issues is you tell them to walk up the mountain. That's the first instruction from Chinese medicine. So we know how good exercise is, there's no doubt. Then you take yoga, and Swami Satchidananda comes over in 1960, when was Woodstock, 67? Is that when it was? Yeah. So he comes over, and he's oming at Woodstock, and it's like, wow, yoga, this stuff is cool. I'm sure that's where my sixth grade social studies teacher got introduced, you know? So we bring yoga over and put it into this context of exercise. And then yoga looks like this, right? Because we're going, it's exercise, it's movement, so faster and sweatier is better, obviously, right? I mean, that's the thinking around it. I want to go, you know, and those packed classes at Asheville Yoga Center are full of, like, hot, sweaty exercise. Even today, they were when I moved here back in the day, and even today, the focus, the value is placed on hard, fast, sweaty exercise. And if you can't do that, then, you know, maybe that's not, maybe you should go jogging or something. You know? but why bother doing yoga? And if you're the other thing is, like, if you're going to do slow, mindful stuff, then that's beginner's yoga. And then people develop complexes around that. Like, obviously I'm a beginner or I'm not good enough to be, I mean, that's part of the issue as well. So that question of what is yoga is really going to be, you know, needs to be unpacked here, because as I'm going to start to explain, there are neurobiologic benefits that are different than those that we get on exercise, although of course there's a little crossover, but they're different. And when we can understand that, we'll understand why these practices have unique value beyond cardiovascular fitness. And that's what's so important to understand. So let's unpack yoga a little bit. You can start, you know, by going back. Some people say that this is Shiva, and some people say yoga goes all the way back to Shiva. And some people say Shiva, some scholars say Shiva was mythologic. Some say he actually lived maybe 7,000 years ago even, we don't know, you know. But there's remnants of Shiva worship even in Norway. That's how far his reach went, you know, all the way out of India, even all the way. They found stuff in Norway that demonstrates that he was very much, mythologically or in real life, he was very much this propounder of the first kind of understanding of what yoga was. And he was about self-realization and science of mind. That's always what attracted me to the study of yoga too, is like the study of the science of mind. What are we as human beings? And then in India, you have people who still worship Shiva. You know, this is a Shiva-worshipping sadhu, probably. And there's wandering ascetics. And, you know, the time I spent about 8 months in India and Nepal, the first time I went, there's people wandering around that are still doing worship to Shiva, and they're often called yogis. And sometimes they're doing yoga postures, but it's typically within some kind of religious context. And then you have Buddhism and Jainism, which are both coming a little bit later than Shiva, maybe 2,000 years ago or so, and both being influenced and influencing yoga, right? So it's been around for a long time. And then, of course, you have yoga postures. So that's one example of a yoga posture. It's not the only one. But that is sort of something that got extracted from yoga in the West as sort of, and then we understand that's what yoga is, you know. Then you have meditation. That's an important part of yoga. And so are breathing practices, right? So there's a whole lifestyle component to yoga, not just postures. And nowadays we know that doctors are recommending yoga to their patients. Medical people are recommending yoga as a way to self-regulate the nervous system. But that's a little contradictory, right? So we have self-regulate the nervous system, but then you go to the gym class and it's hot, fast yoga, which sounds more like cardiovascular exercise. So how do we get, you know, one of the big questions for me as somebody who trains yoga professionals is how do we help educate medical people into helping to get their clients to the right classes so that people are really actually helping to regulate the nervous system and not just doing the hot, fast, sweaty stuff. Not that it's bad. Exercise is not bad. It's just not the only thing that yoga is. And then this last picture I want to unpack about yoga is that yoga is also something that is adaptable to all people. If you can breathe, you can do yoga, right? One of my teachers was on the beach in Hawaii. Like Gary Craftso is his name. He was on the beach in Hawaii and noticed that the horizon started to go like this. He noticed that the horizon had changed in his visual field, and he thought, I better go to the doctor. And they found a tumor the size of a golf ball pressing up into his brainstem, and they immediately rushed him off to surgery and took the golf ball out. And so, you know, that's like a massive surgery to have that done on your brainstem. And when he got up, when he came to from surgery, he couldn't talk, he couldn't move, but he could breathe. And he immediately started breathing practices to help the recovery process. And, of course, the doctors were all amazed at how fast he got better and all that stuff. But I think that's an important piece to remember. And now what's happened in the yoga world in the past, it's been about 5 years now, is that there's been the emergence of a field called yoga therapy. And so there are many people, there's about 3,800 of us now in the country that are you a yoga therapist, Alan Swan? that are practicing to help people to recover from illnesses. So it can be complementary, it can be part of complementary and integrative medicine. So so I wanted to kind of like just unpack it a little bit. And when I teach yoga, it often looks like this, you know, because not like the hot, fast, sweaty stuff, because I'm very interested in making yoga accessible to people. Personally, I'm not an elite athlete, and I'm not even that flexible. But I really love the way that yoga makes me feel. I remember that feeling of Miss Gale's class and floating away, and I wanted to be able to share that with people. So how do we share that with more people? And if you think there's 4 out of 5 people who aren't doing any exercise and who aren't in shape, and if you think there's only 10% of the population that does any yoga at all, then that means there's, you know, 8 or 9 out of 10 people who could really benefit from these practices, but probably don't want to do the sort of mainstream kind of yoga. And we're not doing well enough in serving those populations. And I think we have to find better ways to get to them. And one of the ways that we get to them is we offer practices that are accessible. Now, let's go into the science a little bit about what's going on. And I'm going to have you stand up in a minute here, just not quite yet. I want to tell you about something, first of all, that is often called the sixth sense. It's called proprioception. Have you heard this term before, proprioception? Okay, let's try proprioception. Would you all like to stand up with me for a moment? All I'd like to ask you to do is, without looking, can you sit down in your chair? I'm going to have you stand up again. Did you do it? Okay, you can thank your proprioceptors. Because the proprioceptors are the part of your body that tells you where you are in space. So I can sit down without looking. Isn't that amazing? I mean, that's amazing when you think about it. I don't have to look at the chair to sit down because of that system that orients me in space. And I'm standing up here But for the most part, I'm not falling over this table, even though I'm kind of moving around a little bit. And that's because there's a part of my system that's monitoring where I am in space all the time. It's below the level of consciousness, actually. Proprioception is a really important skill. Now, proprioception is very fast. The mechanoreceptors that are afferent nerves, that means they send messages to your brain, are myelinated. So myelin is the fatty tissue that's on that kind of wraps around the neuron, wraps around the receptor cells, and it has to act really fast. It has to act really fast because it has to constantly adjust you, right? So you're sitting here, by the way, and you're not falling down, and that's because your proprioceptors are just doing little adjustments constantly without you even having to tell them to do it. It's quite amazing, actually. It lies below the level of consciousness. Neuroscientists say 80 to 95% of what we do, what we think, and even what we feel is happening below the level of consciousness. A lot of it is going on all the time. So proprioception is happening quick. And did anybody watch the World Cup lately, the Women's World Cup? Or did you watch Wimbledon? Did you see any Wimbledon? Did you see any sports lately at all? Anything? So, if you've seen any sports lately, that's one of the things you'll notice is how masterful athletes are at proprioception, right? Like they can do these amazing things in kickball. And you'll also notice that with these kind of elite yoga teachers who can stand on one hand or put their foot behind their head and stand on the other foot. You know, that is an incredibly developed sense of proprioception. Right? And proprioception, why do you think proprioception is important? Like for just regular people, not elite athletes. Any ideas?
Balance.
Balance, right. It's part of your vestibular system. It's about balance for sure. Anything else?
Be safe.
To be safe, exactly. Proprioception is what keeps us from bumping into things and hurting ourselves and falling down easily. Oh, I want to tell you one other little cool little tangent thing. When you get into your car and you sit down and you turn on the car and start driving, most of the time you don't hit anything, right? Most of the time. I hit a garbage can recently, but most of the time we don't hit anything, right? And that's because your brain maps out to the car. And your car becomes part of your body, according to your brain. And that's why you don't run into anything, because your proprioceptors are working. I mean, it's just it's phenomenal when you think about it, that we're able to do that. So any kind of yoga that you do, fast yoga, slow yoga, any kind of yoga, is going to increase this sixth sense. It's going to contribute to this proprioception. And it's particularly useful, because most of us have like three or four things we do every day. We do what you're doing now, then we do this, then we do this, and then we lie down, you know? Those are the different movements we do. But in yoga, you're doing all sorts of different, you know, movements, moving around things, and that's constantly challenging your proprioceptors. And so that challenge of the proprioceptors is a good thing. It gives us, it builds that skill. But there's a seventh sense I want to tell you about. Everybody knows the five senses, right? Seeing, touching, smelling, tasting, hearing, thank you, right? So then the sixth sense is proprioception, and then the seventh sense is called something else. It's called interoception. Interoception, it is, what do we feel like inside? How do we feel inside ourselves? So interoception does things like, if you ever notice you're kind of just sitting there and then suddenly you go, and you have a deep breath. Because your interoceptive system is trying to adjust. I mean, that's a little more complicated than that, but it's trying to adjust to make sure that you've got the CO2 oxygen balance going on. Or you may be sitting here right now and it's like 7 o'clock and you're like, yeah, I have a feeling in here in my stomach, and that's going to cause you to walk downstairs and then go across the street and find a restaurant and eat something, right? And so taking care of those feelings, interoception motivates our behavior. Or you're just like, I'm sitting here listening to this talk, but I'm kind of thirsty, so I'm going to have a drink of water. It motivates behavior. And why does it motivate behavior? Because what interoception does is create homeostasis in the system. It's trying to balance you out. Somehow you don't have enough water, so the signals need to go to say, I need to drink more water. You're feeling a full feeling in your bladder. I got to go to the bathroom. motivates behavior to get you back to homeostasis. That's essentially what interoception is. Now, most interoception happens below the level of consciousness, right? Kind of hot, you go over to the thermostat, you turn it up. You might not even be thinking that much when you're doing that, you know? Or you take your, you got your cup of water next to your computer and you have a drink of it, and you don't even necessarily think that about what you're doing. You know, unless the doctor was like, oh, you really need to get more hydration, and then you're like, I'm drinking more water, you know, being more mindful about it. But much interoception also can happen at the level of consciousness. And the way that we can practice interoception is by moving slowly and mindfully and noticing the sensations in our body as we move. And when we do that, we start to notice intrinsic tension patterns in the system. And we go, oh, when I move my neck like this, I feel a stretch here that I didn't even realize I had pain there until I moved, right? This is building the skill of interoceptive awareness. And this skill leads us to not only to helping to unravel some tension patterns, believe it or not, what it also leads us to is a better sense of who we are. It leads us to a sense of identity. The research shows that these interoceptors, which, by the way, I talked about the proprioceptors, they're really fast. Interoceptors are unmyelinated and they're slow. They send the messages slowly, and you find them through slow, mindful awareness, not through fast acting stuff. You don't find them when you're dancing or when you're playing soccer. You find them when you're doing slow, mindful movement. Interoceptors interface with a part of the brain. It's a cortical island in your brain. If I could take my brain and show you the inside of it, pull away, it's over here and over here. Pull away the cortex. There's a little island in there. It's a cortical island. It's called the insula, or the insular cortex. Those little islands are related to how we see ourselves, how we value ourselves, how we understand ourselves. As you do more and more interoception, you get a clearer picture of yourself. When you have a clearer picture of who you are, then you have a better sense of meaning and purpose in your life. And this is why interoception is so important. It helps people get a sense of who they are and what their meaning and purpose is in life. Now, we live in a culture that is very much oriented towards this, proprioception. All our culture is full of sports. Kenneth Cooper wrote the aerobics book. You know, we can go play soccer anytime we want. We can play basketball. You can do any, because we're fit. It's about fitness. It's about moving fast. It's about cardiovascular health. And it's about proprioception. And often, the sort of cult of proprioception is about don't feel your body. Don't feel it. Just do it. Don't feel it. Just do it, right? If you got pain, no gain, right? It's that. So there's many places in our culture where we can proprioception. And it's good. I mean, we need proprioception. I'm not knocking it. I'm not knocking fitness either. We need it. But there are very few places in our culture where we interocept. Very few. You know, interoception happens during mindfulness. It happens during meditation. It happens during slow, mindful movement. And the slow, mindful movement is different than meditation, and it's different than mindfulness, because then you become aware of patterns of tension in your body that you may not have been aware of. Right, so there's something different about the movement, and it's all important, but it's not strong in our culture. And it's only been in the past 13 or 14 years that the scientists have started studying interoception. They weren't studying it before. They just thought, oh, this is what you do when you have to go to the bathroom. They weren't looking at what happens when you make it conscious. When it happens when you move it, it actually moves from the posterior part of your insula to the anterior part of your insula. When you go from the posterior part is I'm not paying any attention. It's just happening. And it's homeostasis. But the anterior part, now it's connecting with front brain system. Now it's starting to develop a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning, a sense of self. All of that stuff is important. Now, what the scientists have shown us is that accurate interoception is correlated with increased vagal tone. The vagus nerve is the largest nerve of the parasympathetic nervous system, and increased vagal tone means that system is working better. The vagus nerve is also about homeostasis, getting us back to what they call parasympathetic homeostasis, being in a place where everything's chill, right? I'm not in fight or flight. I'm in rest and digest and tend and befriend. They also talked about it correlating with heart rate variability. This is your capacity for your heart rate to adapt to different things you're doing. It's resilience, essentially. It's also been correlated with presence and with like a sense of being present, a sense of agency, my ability that or my feelings that I'm in charge, I can do things, I have some sense of control over my life. Agency is very important in terms of psychological well-being. It's also correlated with the capacity to self-regulate, right? Somebody cuts you off in traffic and you don't get out and have road rage. And co-regulation, which has to do with how we regulate each other. So we get better at, you know, your nervous system is not confined to your body. It's very much reaching out and touching everybody else's stuff. So if I look out here and see, and I only see grumpy faces and I watch everybody like falling asleep, then like my nervous system is going to be like, oh, I'm not doing a good job, you know. But I'm looking out and I'm seeing smiling faces and I'm seeing like action and I'm like, okay, all right, it's good. Like the present day, it's not too bad. They're not going to, you know, they're not leaving. So it's good. So that's co-regulation. And we do it all day long. We do it all the time. And the last one, of course, is resilience. So accurate interoception, very important. But many people have poor interoceptive skills. And poor interoception is associated with chronic or persistent pain, which is why one of the most valuable and incredible work you can do for yourself for chronic pain or for if you're a clinician for other people with chronic pain is help them to move slowly and feel the sensations in their body and start to see where they're, what muscles are firing and what muscles aren't firing. And start to reevaluate those movement patterns, because it's those movement patterns that are causing persistent pain as much as any kind of tissue damage. Tissue damage is actually not even part of persistent pain in pain science anymore. That's just the sort of the root of it. But then the brain starts to learn to be in pain because it's been walking like this because you had the tissue damage. Then the pain itself becomes the problem, right? Not the brain, it's brain pain. They call it brain pain. Right, so we start to unravel brain pain. One of the best ways to do that is starting to introduce different movement patterns and ways of moving that have more freedom and fluidity in them. You can find that when you go slow. It's hard to find it when you go fast. Medically unexplained symptoms, which the world is full of them right now with all the autoimmune diseases and so many people having symptoms they can't understand. Many of that is related to poor interoception. It's also related to negative emotions. It's also related to anxiety, an inability to regulate your emotions, even poor decision making, eating disorders. There are several studies that are showing that people with eating disorders, binge eating disorder, anorexia, bulimia, are unable to sense the feelings of hunger accurately in their system. And so there's a correlation there that I think is interesting. We can help people to undo some of those patterns if we can help them teach how to tune into themselves. And then addiction as well, and high blood pressure. There's one more, cancer-related fatigue. Some really interesting research from this guy named Eric Sunin, who's a researcher in England. So what we know is that poor interoception is basically a lack of homeostasis, an inability to come back to neutral. That's the issue with interoception, or with poor interoception, I would say. So poor interoception leads to chronic conditions, right? Maladaptive control of bodily sensations may lie at the heart of many contemporary maladies. I don't know why they have to say it like that, but I like Norman Farb a lot. He's a really interesting mindfulness researcher up in Boston, and then this article is really fascinating. But what he's saying, like, let's just think about it. It's like, okay, I'm really busy. I don't take time to eat good food, for example. I'm just too busy. I got too much going on. I don't take time to manage my stress. I eat junk food. I have high blood pressure. I'm really stressed out. I don't do any exercise, right? And then I've got heart disease, surprise, right? Well, because you didn't stop to notice all the signals your body was sending you. And we live in a culture that values you not noticing that and says, here, take a pill for that. But if we stopped and taught people how to notice it, if we taught kids these skills when they were, you know, in school, like Miss Gale did for me, you know, we would be helping them to develop this skill set earlier on, And, you know, let me just, I hope you don't mind if I go on a little tangent. We are in the middle of a healthcare crisis. We spend $3.2 trillion, which is more than $10,000 per person per year on healthcare. If somebody would just give me that $10,000, I would take care of my health with that, no problem, you know, but that's not how it works. Because 86% of that $3.2 trillion goes to the care of chronic diseases, heart disease, cancers, kidney, you know, diabetes. That's where that money is going. And if the system, if our system, our medical system was accurate, if it was, if the thinking behind it was accurate, if it was valid, we wouldn't be in the middle of this huge healthcare crisis. Which means, you know, and when you have a crisis, it's always based on faulty conceptual models. Always, you know. So you've got to go back to what is the thinking. The thinking is, oh, you have diabetes, so eat less sugar and we'll give you some insulin, you know. Oh, you have heart disease, okay, you should probably walk sometimes and we'll give you some whatever, statins. I don't know what they treat heart disease. We'll give you some medicine for it, you know. When what we're not doing is teaching people health from the beginning, from the, you know, from when they're kids, we're not teaching them health. We're not teaching them how to eat right. We're not teaching them how to manage their stress. And my suggestion is that this piece, this interoceptive piece, is a key piece in the puzzle. And we have to get it out there in a public health context in a way that people start to understand that if all your energy is just going out all the time, and you're stressed, and you're doing sports or whatever, or you're moving your body, but you're not stopping and turning things in, then we're not going to be able to push this juggernaut of healthcare crisis in the other direction. Okay, I'll get off the soapbox, but that is a huge piece of why this stuff is so important. It's not just like, oh, I should do some relax. You know, when I was trying to explain back in the early 2000s, I moved to Asheville, and I was like, well, it's relaxing. That's all I knew to say. You know, now I understand the science behind it, and this stuff is critical for health and well-being. It's not just like something else to do, or like a little bit less sort of real yoga, you know, or like beginner's yoga or gentle. It's not that. This is just as important to everyone's health as any other self-care activity that they engage in. It's that important because you're building a skill that helps people to take care of themselves, and it's internal, you know, and you're rewiring their whole nervous system. It's really important. There's four ways that the brain changes, according to Dan Siegel. He says it changes by focused awareness, by repetition, by passion, and by novelty. Those are four, and there's other ways, but that's Dan Siegel's little, he's a neuroscientist, that's his little formula. Focused awareness, repetition, passion, and novelty. And because I repeated that, I just helped you change your brain. So I want to talk about focused awareness, because that's what interoception is, right? With interoception, we stop and we notice. And this is what Norman Doidge, who wrote the book, The Brain's Way of Healing, and then he also wrote the book, The Brain That Changes Itself. This is what he says about slow mindful movement. He was specifically talking about Feldenkrais here, and Feldenkrais is a form of slow mindful yoga. Slowness of, although the Feldenkrais people might not like me saying that, but it is. Slowness of movement is the key to awareness, and awareness is the key to learning. Slower movement leads to more subtle observation and map differentiation, so that more change is possible. So what's map differentiation? That's like noticing, like there's different areas of my body, and as I get clearer about those different areas of my body, you know, you're very innervated like here and in your face and in your feet, but as I start to notice different areas of my body, then I can change things, I can start to make changes. So he thinks that the slow movement is actually critical for neuroplasticity, right? So why does slowness, well, why does awareness matter? I just want to kind of wrap this up a little bit. Stress is a huge part, you know, it's at the core of everything. Stress leads to intrinsic tension patterns in the body, and a lack of sense of self is the other piece I should have put in here. Not knowing who I am, basing who I am on everything outside of me, not on inside of me. That's called exteroception, actually. You know, people who have, I worked in intensive outpatient drug and alcohol treatment clinic for a couple of years, and people who are dealing with addiction problems often are masterful at exteroception. They know what everything is going on outside of themselves, and very, very deficient at interoception, of knowing how they feel inside. So stress leads to this intrinsic means below the level of consciousness, intrinsic tension, I'm not aware of it, and that leads us to illness, right? Awareness is how we start unraveling the equation. I want to show you just a couple other research studies, or just one research study actually, about depression. Holger Kramer is a researcher in Germany. I love him. He's like my hero. He's at an institute for integrative medicine. I can't remember exactly where he is in Germany, but he's always researching yoga. And one of and he does meta-analysis, which is like the good, you know, the highest form of research. So one of his studies, he said, yoga, especially meditation-based forms of yoga, so meditative yoga, could be considered an ancillary treatment option for individuals with elevated levels of depression. He says, and elsewhere in this article, he says it's the mindful meditative yoga that helps people to undo depression, which is exactly what I've just been talking about. Yeah. So that doesn't mean exercise isn't good for depression. You should probably exercise too. But this has a different, you know, it has a different understanding. So I think the paradigm is starting to shift. There's been a dominant paradigm and there's an emerging paradigm. The dominant paradigm has been fit the body into the shapes of the form, like do asanas because that's the way it's supposed to look. And the emerging paradigm is asanas serve your body, like do what your body needs, not try to look like a certain asana. That's kind of exciting. Does somebody know what asana means? It means a yoga posture, yeah. The body and mind are distinct. Use the mind to subdue the body. That's been a dominant paradigm, right? And there's a new emerging paradigm that says the body and mind are interwoven allies. Use the body-mind in a holistic alliance. Listen to your body, right? Not just try to dominate the body. That's very, like, that whole dominate the body thing, you know, that's very colonial. Really, it's like from colonialism. It really is. You know, it really goes back there. And we're moving away from that. And so the dominate the body, listen to the body, right? The body doesn't need to be dominated. It needs to be your ally and your friend. Control the body, befriend the body, right? Finding a friendship. And just do it or allow and notice. And I also should put in there, no pain, no gain, and no pain, no pain. No pain, no pain. That's really what we're looking for. So I sometimes call these two different ways of thinking about yoga, fitness yoga or exercise, and then innercise or resilience, nervous system resiliency building yoga is the way I like to think about it. So fitness yoga is about strength, flexibility, and stamina. Innercise yoga, and the goal of fitness yoga is cardiovascular fitness, right? It's just like any kind of exercise. Innercise yoga, we're trying to look for tend and befriend, which is a way of thinking about your nervous system, that you come to this place of kindness to yourself, self-compassion. Lots of research out there about the benefits of self-compassion. And you're trying to come to more of physiologic balance and be able to navigate the different aspects of the nervous system, the fight or flight response, or this tend and befriend response, or the rest and digest response. They're all slightly different, but those are all responses in the nervous system we're trying to navigate. And it builds physiologic balance and mental health. And the goal is really nervous system resilience, not cardiovascular exercise. Now, that doesn't mean that these things do not intersect. They very much intersect, but I like to keep them a little bit separated just to help you get it in your mind that there's something different. And slow, mindful movement is not inferior to fast fitness movement. It has a different goal. The goal is nervous system resilience as opposed to cardiovascular exercise. Does that make sense? After everything I've talked about here? Yeah. Okay, so this is just my last slide here to give you a couple of bullet points to leave with. Slow practice builds awareness. This facilitates neuroplasticity. We start to change the nervous system with awareness. That's why we can undo some of the patterning, for example, of chronic pain with slow, mindful movement. Slow, mindful movement builds these interoceptive attention skills, and this can lead to improved health outcomes. You saw, remember the slide with all the interoceptive stuff. And then slow develops nervous system resilience and psychological flexibility, leads to a deeper sense of identity, meaning, and purpose, and is different from but complements exercise. Okay, so I want to show you one thing we could do together, if you could stand up, to I use this a lot to talk to teach students about the difference between, it's so simple. So like, here's the difference between proprioception and interoception. Okay, so if you would, you're welcome to hold a chair, or you don't have to, but if you want to hold a chair, you can. I would request that you stand on one foot. You can take your shoe off if you want. And if you want, you could even do tree pose. You could even put your foot on your ankle. Oh, I'm doing it in high heels, so that's even different. Okay, now, did you notice that your body can balance on one foot? Okay, so do it the other way, because you got to balance out. So you can stand on one foot. Did you notice that? Okay. So that, noticing that is noticing that, that's why you can have the chair, but noticing that is proprioception, right? Just like, that's my proprioception. I can stand on one foot. I don't even really have to think about it. I can do it, right? Now, the next thing is stand on one foot. You can choose whichever one you want. And as you're standing on one foot, I would like to direct your attention to your foot that you're standing on. And for most of you, you'll notice it's doing this, yeah? And maybe the first time you did it, you didn't notice that. You just were standing on one foot. Is that true? Some of you might have been noticing it, some of you might not. If you practice interoception a lot, you might have noticed it. Okay. Now you can do the other side, because we got to get balanced out here. So as you're standing on the other side, notice that your foot's doing all that stuff. Now, you noticing what your foot is doing is interoception. You standing here on one foot is proprioception. You noticing it is interoception. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So that's the difference between them. So that would mean if you're at the gym, I don't know if you ever do this, but if you ever go to the gym, you get on the machine and you put in your earbuds and then you start watching Mad Men on Netflix or something. That's not what I do. But you know, and you're on your machine and you're doing it, and then 30 minutes are up and you just like had a nice time watching Mad Men and you got your workout in. You did a lot of proprioception because you didn't fall over. But if you go to yoga and you lie on your back and you spend an hour moving slowly and noticing all the sensations in your body, then you're doing interoception. Those are different, right? Those are different. So that's what I hope that you leave with, is that understanding that these are different things. Now, when they merge, when you get proprioception and interoception, then you have these really elite athleticism or dance, you know, beautiful dance, beautiful, all that stuff. That's when those things, you're using both of them. But, you know, not all of us need to do that or want to do that necessarily. Okay, so why don't I pause for a moment and see if anybody has questions, and then we'll finish up with just a couple little movement things. That's my information, by the way. Anything you were kind of thinking about or wanted to ask about before we... You can keep standing, I don't mind. Okay, so should we do... I know it's a little bit late. Should we do a couple of things on my little sheet here? You probably want to move. Let's do number three. I love number one, I have to say. These rotations, dry rotations, we could have just been doing them the whole time I was talking. We could have been rotating our joint rotations are great, particularly for your proprioceptors. You can do your ankles too, because the proprioceptors are in the joints. But then you do it with mindful awareness, and you bring your interoceptive, those low threshold mechanoreceptors, the interoception in too. So joint rotations are great. The yogis think of them as very soothing and calming to the nervous system to move the joints. Yeah. But go ahead and stand up, and I want to show you number three. I call this one Compassionate Mountain. You can do it with an intention. When you place your hands on the body, it also increases your interoceptive awareness, because now you get a little focal point. So for this one, on the inhale, you just take the arms out to the side. If you like, you can lift your eye. And when you exhale, you let your hands come back to your heart. And if you like, you can switch which hand comes to the heart first, and you lower your face. Now, one thing you could add to this is, and I don't want to do it in my shoes, you could add to this is you lift up on your toes. So then you get a little challenge to your balance. So lots of awareness as you're doing it, sensations in your body. And the nervous system loves smooth, fluid movement. Let the movement be nice and smooth and fluid. So one more. And then when you finish this time, you can just stop with your hands on your chest and take a moment and notice. Feel free to close your eyes. When you close your eyes, you shut down the visual cortex, which takes up to 70% of our attention. So when you close your eyes, that you take that attention, you can take it inside and notice. Just what does it feel like as your hands rest on your chest? How does that feel in your chest? Yeah. Now another thing you can do here is something called embodied cognition. So what you can do with your hands is maybe take an idea like kindness and put kindness in my heart, right? Something like that, or friendliness, right? Or compassion for something that your heart might have struggled with, right? Something like that. So those kinds of, bringing those kinds of, which in yoga we'd call that mantra, you know, or sankalpa maybe, intention, you know, bringing that into the practice. Here's another one you can do with your hand. So we'll just do right hand. I'll do with my left hand. So just right hand, take a breath in. And then when you exhale, put it on your opposite chest and twist and look behind you. And then come back to center, both hands. And then do it with your left hand. So this is just a gentle way of twisting. I'm just placing my hand on my chest below the collarbone. You can do this one also. Real easy to do like this, right? And then if you like, you could stay. Whichever side you're on, you could stay there for a moment and breathe and notice. And then you could do the other side. Put your hand on your chest and gentle twist and breathe and notice. And then back to center. Okay, so one of the things I like to say all the time is the pause is just as important as the pose. So when you finish what we just did, then you can stop and lower or close your eyes. And then notice the residual sensations in your body, like particularly on below your collarbones. Do you notice some sensations there? You may notice some sensations in your upper back. And you notice the sensation of the breath moving in and out. And then one more I would try. You can do this one with a chair. So this is more like a real yoga pose. You can step your left foot forward, your right foot back. And you can do the same thing with your arms that we did in mountains. When you inhale, bend your knee and arms come out to the side. Or maybe if you feel like I need a little more energy, take your arms straight up as you bend your knee. And exhale back down. And let's do two more of those. So you can choose. You can take your arms straight up or maybe bend the elbows out to the side. And then next time you bend your front knee and take your arms up or out, stay there for a moment. So the eyes lift. And see if you can feel kind of an open feeling in your chest. You get a little sense of openness in your chest. You can do this one sitting down. Just do your arms if you want, unless you hurt your shoulder, but if it feels okay. And lift your eyes, and then take a moment to let your breath, as if you're massaging your chest from the inside with your breath. Stretching the muscles from the inside with your breath. One more. And then release your hands down, straighten your front leg, and come back to neutral. And then just take a moment, and you're welcome to soften or close your eyes. How does your breath feel? How does your energy feel after you did that? You feel a little... maybe a little openness, a little rising feeling of energy maybe. That noticing, that stopping and noticing, that's what starts to create the neuroplastic changes. If you don't stop and notice, you just gloss over it. Right? So do the other side because we don't want to be imbalanced. So your other foot back. So if you like, you can do arms out. Inhale and then exhale. Or if you prefer, you might want to take your arms way up when you inhale. Let's do two more. Nice and smooth, right? The nervous system likes that smooth, fluid movement. Now let's stay here. Couple of breaths. if you can make your breath a little bit bigger in your chest, see if you can feel the chest opening. So you might have to bend your elbows to open your chest. That's okay. One more. And then release your hands down, step your back foot forward. And let's do one more thing before we finish. It's not on your handout. And this is called rebounding. So you just let your knees, it's got a technical name for jiggling around. And let yourself jiggle around a little bit. And this is very hydrating for the connective tissue, actually. It brings more, you know, you're made of water, so you're just letting that water jiggle around in your body. And it's actually really nice for your nervous system. Yeah, so just take a moment and pause and notice how you feel after that very simple stop. Okay, so I think I'm going to wrap it because we're a little late. So I want to thank you for being here, and I want to thank Integrative Family Medicine for having me. I love what you're doing. It's such a great practice, and I'm just really honored that you had me here, and thank you all for coming.